Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This episode of Silent Giants is brought to you by Ally. Ally, powered by Verizon Locations, are developed by Verizon, the world's leading technology company. In collaboration with Ally, a membership-only community workspace for creators. Each location is a community curated powered by the emerging technologies and thought leadership of Verizon. With Ally, Verizon is bridging the gap between startup and corporation by helping the community workspace build next-level ecosystems for entrepreneurs.
And now, on to my interview with Mary Wood.
Learning about the business around you, but don't let the business side of it lead you. I think let your heart lead you, because when your heart leads you, that's where you're going to be really successful.
Yeah, check it out. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. Everybody tuning in, you invited. No matter what mood you in, get excited. Everybody love the music. Let me tell you how they do it. Whether writer or an agent, let me tell you how they made it. You are now talking to a silent giant. Wanna walk in their shoes, silent giants. Wanna study they move, silent giants. Wanna know what they do, silent giants. Silent giants, y'all.
Welcome to the Silent Giants Podcast. A podcast highlighting the superstars behind your favorite superstars and creative industries. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge. To keep up with the latest on the show, be sure to follow us on Instagram at Silent Giants Podcast. To keep up with my life, music, and more, be sure to follow me as well at Corey Cambridge. This week's Silent Giant is music entrepreneur, singer, songwriter, and producer, Mary Wood. Mary is the founder of Frisbee, a company that specializes in writing for television commercials, sound design, movie scoring, and brand consulting. Mary has written, performed, and produced for some of the most recognizable brands, like Pepsi, 7-Up, and many others. Her work as a musical TV giant led her to write songs for A-list artists like Aretha Franklin, Britney Spears, Jordan Sparks, Isaac Hayes, Kiss, Faith Hill, Jessica Simpson, The Spice Girls, and countless others. In this interview, I stopped by her Tribeca studio to chat about her upbringing in New Hampshire, how she got into music, moving to NYC, getting into commercial advertising, writing the Joy of Pepsi jingle, being in the studio with Aretha Franklin, founding her own company, and a whole lot more. So, without further ado, let me introduce you to the entrepreneur, producer, singer, songwriter, my friend, the silent giant, Mary Wood.
Yo, what up?
What up?
I'm hanging out with Mary Wood right now. What's up, Mary?
What's up?
How are you?
I'm good. Just chilling.
Just chilling?
Just chilling right now.
I'm enjoying the atmosphere right now. It feels like an episode of Friends.
Exactly. Yeah. This is my home space. Yep.
I walked in like, wow, I didn't even know these places even exist. And it's real.
It's real. Exactly. Like I said, this was exactly how I felt when I first saw the space. I was like, wow, this is what I thought New York would be like right when I got here. And it was not like this. But
how long have you been in the space?
Now I've been here for 12 years.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's the crib right
here.
I'm knocking
wood on the 12-year crib.
Hey, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Look, consistency in New York is really, really hard.
It is.
And you're the model of consistency.
Yep. Although it's a consistent inconsistent. You know what I mean? I always say, I feel like every couple of years, there's a reinvention that happens to stay consistently successful. So
there we go.
Yeah.
Well, look, every great artist or business have to pivot.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Apple was making computers.
Yep.
Now they're making watches.
Look at them now. Now they're making robots.
Now they're making robots. You know what I mean? Like, who would have thought? Apple's turning into Samsung now.
Exactly. I know.
So how long have you been here in New York?
So I've been in New York for 20 years.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yo, you're a New Yorker for real.
Oh, yeah. I know. When I said I'm from New Hampshire, I thought, you know, I really feel more like a New Yorker. I feel like I'm from Brooklyn at this point. But I was born and raised in New Hampshire.
Wait, so what year did you move here to New York?
So I moved to New York in the 90s. And I guess it was like 92. And I've been here since.
What was it like then?
It was dirty. It was crowded. I mean, coming from where I came from, it felt very intense, but exciting at the same time. because I you know, I really was inspired by career ideas and goals. And so it was sort of a complex situation for me. But I realized pretty quickly, like, I can stay here and I can be successful, but I'm going to have to be able to leave every couple weeks and get out and go to the country.
Yeah, yeah. I call it thawing out.
Yeah, exactly. Thawing out. Yeah, I needed to do that. I definitely needed to do that.
Anyway, so you are originally from New Hampshire?
Yes.
Yo, very, very pleasant place.
Very pleasant. I grew up in a college town where Dartmouth College is.
Very, oh, get out.
Very small, beautiful, insulated community, which in hindsight was great. I was pretty ready to flee from there when I was about 16. I was like, all right, I'm done with this. I got this. I need to go explore more.
Did your parents work for the university?
Yeah, my dad was a medieval history professor and was head of the history department.
Deep.
Yeah, deep. Super deep. Yeah, no
the medieval
kidding.
Medieval history. Like, yeah,
no.
Damn.
No, yes. Not fucking around.
So, what's your mom?
So my mom was a learning specialist at a school right outside of Hanover, and then was also, you know, pretty much our mom. You know, didn't work for a long time. And then when I was, I guess when I got into middle school, she became a learning specialist. But she had, you know, she went to college and majored in philosophy and literature and was, you know, had career goals, but I think ultimately decided, you know, I have three siblings, so there were four of us. So her main job, I think, was taking care of us.
Where'd you rank in the sibling?
Youngest.
You're the youngest.
Yes.
Oh, you had it so good.
I did.
For real.
I'm not going to lie. I had it so good.
Like, no, the youngest, they get away with more. The parents are just so chill. Like,
oh, God.
They're
yes.
Like, yo, look, we've been through this like three times already.
I'm the poster child. Like, one of my sisters is like 8 years older than me. So, you know, she was like at Harvard by the time I was in fifth grade. So I was like, yo, you did fine with her. Like, whatever I do, it's going to be cool. Don't worry.
Like, living in like such a academic setting, was there any pressure on you to be super academic?
Yeah, there definitely was. And I think I don't know, how would I describe that? There was a ton of pressure to achieve. And I think I just always looked at it like I had to carve out my own way of doing it. So like, if everyone was, you know, swimming and doing great in school, I was like, I'm just going to go do music. Like, I kind of needed my own path. So yeah, I just sought it out.
How did that path happen for you where you were going to get into music?
That happened totally organically. Like, I always loved singing. Like, I just would sing myself to sleep every night. Like, I was making up songs all the time. Like, I just loved music. And I think my parents were a little perplexed by it. They were like, oh, you just want to be different. Like, that's why you're. And I was like, no, this is what I need to do to live and breathe. Like, I just always felt like I needed to do music. And then, you know, so I did the usual stuff, like chorus, and got as involved as I could in music and school. And then in high school, a good friend of mine was like a really good keyboard player, and he's like, we got to just start a band. And that's when it all that's when the cracks in the veneer started. And we started a rock band, and I was lost to music after that.
Wait, instrument did you play? Were you a lead singer?
I was just the lead singer.
Oh, you would just fly.
I was just, yeah, forget it. Yeah. You know, sometimes I would help carry the instruments. Yeah, exactly. No, I just was the singer in the band.
And so what was the name of the band?
It was called Zorn.
You say it with so much pride.
Yeah, Zorn was the it came from this book called Watership Down, and it basically in the book it had its own vocabulary, and Zorn meant destruction. So that was the name of our band.
Wow. Yeah. What kind of music was it?
It was actually pretty eclectic. There was a lot of pop music, but like the drummer was really into like Led Zeppelin, and I was into other like more like pop R&B. So it was a very eclectic mix of cover songs. And then we like wrote a few originals, but it was very mixed.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, so like you're in school now and your parents are like accepting of this. They're like, you know, Mary's, we've been through this before. Mary's good, you know?
Yeah, I think they were pretty accepting. You know, I was making money. Like, we would play a lot of frat parties at Dartmouth and make money, like, doing the shows. I think they got a certain kick out of it. And I was still doing certain, you know, sports like tennis and skating. And I was still, like, achieving in ways that were probably slightly more comfortable for them. So they're like, okay, this is just this sideline that's cool for now.
Did you have more of like the like lead singer part role of the band, or was there more like administrative back end managing business stuff?
None of that.
At that time?
Okay. Yeah, no, there was none of that. Really, the keyboard player was the guy that went out and like got us the gigs and had the big plan to just like rule. and he's like, you're the singer and you just do this thing. So that, yeah, the business part of it was really pretty far away from my reach at that point. I just wasn't thinking like that. I definitely liked making money, but I wasn't setting out to do it
so
at
that
point.
There's like a... I don't know. People have like their practical goals.
Yeah.
That they have when they're kids of like, and like yeah. The music's like the lofty goal.
Yeah.
Or like being in the NBA.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was your like practical like job that you wanted as a kid?
Yeah. Actually, that's kind of hilarious. I don't think I had a practical goal. I think I really was just like, well, I love singing so much and I love music so much. I just want to be like a rock star. Like I just want to do music. And, you know, in that experience in being in a band in high school, like I made decent money, so I was like, hey, I'm kind of like this could work for me. That's what I was thinking, you know. But then I got to New York and was like, no, it doesn't work like that. Like in New York, you come here and you basically pay to play.
Oh yeah,
because you're paying for rehearsals, you're paying for spaces, you're paying for. I was like, oh wow, I had it really good.
Yeah, I was like making money in Virginia.
Yeah, right,
like off your craft. And here it's just very different.
No, it's like, no, you pay us. So that was pretty eye-opening.
Where did New York come from? Where did the idea come from to move here?
I thought it was a safe bet. I went to college at Sarah Lawrence.
Oh, how was that?
Yeah, I loved it. Like, I basically...
All girls school, right?
Yeah, it's. I think there's about 20%
dudes?
Male. Yeah.
I want
to
go.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like, if you go to Sarah Lawrence now, doing? It's like either you're gay or you're a total, like, macking.
Or winning.
Yeah, or just winning. Or just winning. Exactly. That's exactly what it is. But it's really artsy, and it's for someone like me that was pretty self-directed in a specific way, it was nice because they let you kind of create your own curriculum to achieve the goals that you want. And so for me, it was great because I wanted to do pop music or contemporary music, and I wanted to be a performer, and I wanted to know a certain amount about business, but I also wanted to... Because my dad was a medieval historian, I had a real sense of responsibility to get a liberal arts education, which I could do there. So I like had a focus in philosophy and in music, which was just great. So I loved it. I didn't want to leave. I loved it.
Wow. Wait, yeah. Where is Sarah Lawrence?
It's in Bronxville, New York. So it's basically the Bronx. Like, it's sort of hilarious. It's like on the border of Yonkers and the Bronx, but their mailbox is in Bronxville, which is a very fancy address.
Yeah, they were like, we can't have the Bronx.
No.
Let's throw a bill behind
it.
No,
we can add like a few more zeros to the tuition.
Bronxburg.
Yeah. Add a few more zeros on there. So it's a pretty, I'm very lucky that I got to go there. My dad, I really didn't want to go to college. I just wanted to go pursue my band.
Yeah.
And then he's like, you have to go to college. I don't care what you learn. You just need to learn how to learn. So then I was like, okay, I want to go to Sarah Lawrence. And he was like, I don't think you have the clothes for that school. Like, that's like a crazy fancy school. But God bless my dad. He helped me go there.
And so that was because the reason why you went to Sarah Lawrence was because you wanted to have proximity to New York City?
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. I thought about NYU, and then I just thought, you know what? I was a pretty wild child, and I just really thought I might not ever go to class if I, coming from New Hampshire, moved to Manhattan. I just knew myself well enough to know that it might not go well.
Were you still in the band while you were... were you still in the band while you were in college?
No, we all went to college, and we kind of broke up the band. And then I was in other bands in college, like here and there, but did a lot of just like solo performances or like, you know, throw together coffee house things and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so you're done with school.
Yeah.
And then you're like, yo, all right, dad, like it's my time.
Oh yeah.
So I'm moving to New York City.
Yeah.
Where'd you move to?
So I moved to first apartment was, the scenic view of the Midtown Tunnel.
Oh.
It was awful. Fifth floor walk-up of, you know, at like 33rd and 3rd Avenue. It was so loud. tar roof, fifth floor. It was so hot. I was so broke. It was just, it was awful.
And so when you get into New York,
yeah,
and you're hitting the pavement, you're like working on your career. Like, what was your focus? What was your goal at that time?
Yeah, I really wanted to be, you know what? It's funny because when I think back, it's like, it was just not a focused goal other than to be like a famous, like, I just wanted to be a rock star. I was just like, okay, I'm writing my songs. I've got my little setup at home. And I was just like writing and really wanted, I basically, my goal was to get a record deal, I guess you would say. That was really the goal. But I also needed to make money. So when I was pounding the pavement, the two things were not congruous. Like, I didn't think I would get a record. I was realistic. I didn't think I'd get a record deal right away. So my first job was actually through a friend of mine from Sarah Lawrence, who was a writer. And she had been offered this job working for a literary agent that she turned down. But she's like, oh, you should talk to my friend Mary. So I ended up working for a literary agent, just like screening novels for her and being her assistant.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a very odd situation.
Yeah, you're making a rent.
Yeah, I was making the rent. But she also, I guess there was a little bit of a, you know, some sort of preemptive vision of, the literary agent was renting her office from an ad agency. So I got a real sense of what advertising was while I was working for her. But then I kind of got tired of that job and I was like, wow, I don't really have enough time to write songs. I really just feel like I should be writing songs. Like, that's just like drinking water for me. I need to be doing music. So I quit and I just got a job as a waitress. And I just worked as a waitress and worked my way up to getting really good shifts so I could just work like 3 nights a week and make good cash and then just be home all the time making music.
Wait, so how long were you being a waitress for?
That was like 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so at this point you're like, it's like 97 or something?
Yeah. So then I was like, now I'm really, the pendulum swings and I'm like, I'm a college graduate. Like, now I'm really sick of waitressing. Like, I'm going to go get another day job. So then I got a job working in a recording studio that, I guess advertising was just following me, because this recording studio where I got a job happened to be, I didn't even research it, honestly. I was just like, oh, recording studio, great, I'll take this job. And then it turned out they really didn't do music there. They just did like voiceovers and post-production.
Okay.
For ads.
Okay.
So I did that job for a while.
It's like the universe just keeps speaking to you.
Exactly. And then a music producer from an ad agency that was working there met me and he offered me a job in a music department at an ad agency. So I sort of like went.
What was that job?
I was a secretary for him. Answering phones, basically, listen, you know, screening some music and answering phones, but it was just basically being an assistant, you know, as far as the day-to-day responsibility, filing some contracts and things like that. But like big picture, I was just absorbing like, oh, there's this whole world of music for commercials. Like, I didn't really ever think about that.
Yeah.
For me, even though I always loved commercials when I heard them on TV and I have a very short attention span, so I think I retain stuff like that really well. And like, but it was a really good eye opener to like, oh, okay, this is a whole field of music that I never really considered.
Yeah, because at the time your mind was still wrapped around the concept of you being a rock star touring.
Yeah, exactly.
Because what was your musical style like?
It was
for
more
your solo stuff.
It was I would say it was like super melodic pop, but with definitely a little bit of like an R&B influence. But I was really doing everything myself, so I wouldn't say it was great, but that was kind of where I was at. Like, I would program my own beats and do my thing, but it was definitely like an R&B pop kind of vibe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what was like your turning point or light bulb moment in your career where you were like, oh, this is the direction I'm going to go?
Oh, yeah. So after I had that job as a secretary, I got another job at an ad agency called Saatchi & Saatchi. And I sort of like talked my way into being a music producer there just based on, you know, production work I had done. And I just remember being in a meeting where they were talking about the next campaign for this like hair care product. And I was like, well, why don't we do, I kind of think like this kind of music would be great, or maybe do something like this. And everybody was listening to me. And they actually did what I suggested. And the next thing I knew, 2 days later, I was in the studio producing a track like the suggestion that I had made. So that was like a huge thing. I was like, wow, I actually, that just felt like very much enabled me to feel some confidence in my vision and in my sense of music and in branding, frankly. And then after that, like not long after that, another campaign came along for Cheerios where they were looking for a song and everybody was super stumped at the agency. And finally I was like, well, I just wrote some lyrics and wrote a song. And I was like, how about this? And everyone was like, oh, yeah, this is great. Like, let's do this. So they ended up using my song and my words for this Cheerios campaign. They put the lyrics on the box and I was like, wow,
get out.
Yeah, wait, exactly. Wait, I was like, get out.
Wait, hold on. So at this point you mentioned you were a singer. How did you get into producing music? Like, well, how did that even happen?
Yeah, so I mean, I just always had, like, just to date myself, like I always had like a four track, I had a drum machine and a keyboard, and I was just doing it like a fish to water. Like I was just always making stuff to try to showcase my own songs. So then when this Cheerios thing came up, I was like, I'll just like make this little demo. And, you know, truth be told, like once the demo was done, then we did go into a studio and we blew it out and we made it like a bigger production. But I really just learned by doing, because I really needed to show myself and show when I wanted to show my own songs. I was really just teaching myself as I went.
Wow.
Yeah.
So wait, so what's that process like of, like, you're a music person, right?
Yeah.
And you create essentially the tagline or
yeah,
I don't know the exact marketing term. I guess tagline?
Yeah, for a totally. Product? Yeah, or a jingle.
Jingle?
Yeah.
So when it gets placed on the box, like, how does that business-wise work?
Yeah, okay, great question, because that leads to the next. So it was so funny because I was like, wow, I'm so glad they like this. And it's so cool. And then it goes on the box like, hey, did you know? Cheerios, blah, 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 blah. I was like, holy shit. And then the guy that was my boss at the time was like, it's not okay that you did that. And I was like, it's not okay that I did that? Like the Cheerios is used. And I didn't get paid anything extra because I had signed something when I started. I think it's pretty standard that when you work at an agency, like anything you do, they own. It's like it's just a global work for hire thing, which I was fine with. Like, hey, I was making money. I was paying my rent. Like I was not looking for more money. But then I got sort of the wrist slap of like, don't do that because it's a conflict of interest. Like you're supposed to be hiring other people to do this. So like if you're doing that, it's not cool. Like,
yeah.
So that's when I left.
Over the last couple of days, I've been doing a lot of research and interviewing people. Because Silent Giants, and now like, oh, I think it's outside of the box beyond just like, you know, music of like what's number one on Billboard.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about like, who writes these taglines? Like who writes Just Do It?
Right. Exactly.
Who wrote Skittles Taste the Rainbow?
Yeah. Exactly.
Like these are so recognizable. And then I was, a friend of mine called me up other night and was like, yo, meet me at this bar. I'm working. I could get some drinks. It's all right. Cool, man. So I roll out the crib and I meet this guy who works in advertising.
Mm.
And we have this whole conversation that's like, yeah, well, I come up with this topic, this copy, but I don't get any credit for it at all.
No, exactly.
And I don't like that.
Yeah.
Did you feel conflicted with that as well?
Well, you know, as far as the getting credit, I honestly didn't care. I think like the affirmation was enough for me.
Yeah.
Like it just gave me, because I think coming from where I came from such an academic family, and there was always sort of this lingering doubt that I was able or that I had the ability or that I had what it took. So it was pretty cool just to get that. And it was just, I just looked at it as a springboard, you know, because I think at the time, looking at it, I think I also didn't understand how much money I could or should have been making from coming up with that.
Yeah.
But again, I look at it as like, well, that was the point. That was the springboard that got me to my next place and gave me the confidence to say, okay, I can do this, and now I can do this independently and make the kind of money I'm supposed to make.
What was that next move for you?
So the next move for me was I went to a company called Crushing Music.
Okay.
And that basically happened by me. I asked another music friend, I was like, what would you do if he was an older guy who had a music company? And I was like, and I had hired him, and I was like, I don't know, I'm at this crossroads. And he was like, God, he lived in LA, and he was like, if you came to me asking for a job, I would hire you. Maybe you should go to the company that you think you'd be best suited for and ask them for a job. So that's what I did. I went to this company called Crushing, and it was owned by this guy named Joey Levine, who was like the king of, literally the king of bubblegum music. Like, he wrote all these bubblegum hits, Yummy Yummy, I've Got Love in My Tummy, all these Archie's hits. He wrote Sometimes You Feel Like a Nut, Sometimes You Don't, like all these huge hits. So I was like, hey, I know I'm a pop writer. So I went to him and I said, I'd really love to work for you if you could ever figure out a way that I could have a job here. And like a month later, he called me up and he's like, okay, you can work for me. Here's what I want you to do for me. And if you're down, let's do it. And
wow.
And I made the jump. So basically he had kind of said, find me new talent. You know, daily responsibilities were like, find new talent, which I love doing, you know, maybe a little sales, which I hate doing. And then I had said to him, like, hey, I'd love to chime in and write stuff when I think I'm right for it. And he was like, you can absolutely do that. Just do that on your own time. Like after 6 o'clock, take it home, write stuff. So it was really fun. It was definitely, I think, very much in keeping with the ad world then, and probably now it's like very male.
I was going to touch on that because you're a lady boss.
I was the only woman there except for the sales rep and the receptionist. And I was the only one that was kind of like ultimately that became a creative force there that was actually like earning.
Yeah. I mean, even on Silent Giants, I have this conflict of like,
yeah,
it's just a really dude dominated space.
Yeah.
It's way too dude.
But weirdly, I'm super comfortable in way too dude. Like I've always been a tomboy. And I think doing sports so much, like I've always just been really comfortable in what feels like a healthy competitive environment.
Yeah.
And also like in the sense that like you're supportive of everybody. And it is weird where when you're writing for hire, there is this element of competition, but you're supporting each other and contributing. And so I think being a team player, like I was just writing something recently about my experience at Crushing, and I was like, and I was the only female writer, and I was like, I never really thought of it like that, but I was. And for, you know, 12 years, I was the only female writer.
But you would imagine, though, it's kind of weird in the sense that a woman's perspective is super important.
Exactly.
Right? Like if I'm doing an ad for Dove, I feel like I would want a woman to write the ad for Dove.
No, exactly. So I got lucky with certain things where they're like, oh, we would like the female perspective. Like that's really helpful. But I think to a degree, there's just like this level of just like, well, we don't care. Like we know what's marketable. And I think there's a certain amount of just people being very presumptuous about what women want and what they think, and they don't really. It was pretty rare that, like, I don't even think I won very many things that were female oriented products.
Weird.
Kind of funny.
Yeah, I feel like I would like monopolize that. Like, if I had like a black guy on the team, I'd be like, yo, fam, Mickey D's? Like,
but like, I was always raised like, don't let being a woman hold you back. Like, don't let being a girl, like you, like my dad always said, like, we kind of raised you like without gender. Like, that's what he always said. And I think I kind of brought that to my world at Crushing. Like, it was just kind of like, I'm just here to play the team. And like, oh, you want me to put my girl hat on? Okay. But it's literally putting the girl hat on, because I think I kind of can roll just with a more universal view, which is probably why I did well with bigger things like a soda or a snack food, just like feeling good and, you know, and less specific as far as like what a woman would want. Or
Well, I think also too, maybe operating in a space of like being a woman in a male dominated space, or being like a black man in a white dominated space.
Yeah.
You just get used to being uncomfortable. You think that's a part of it too? It's like being uncomfortable is the norm. So it's not uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, and honestly, it's so, sounds so funny, but like, I'm such a tomboy that like, the very first time I met Joey Levine, he said to me, he looked at my nails and he said, oh, you don't get manicures? And I burst out laughing, because like where I grew up, like wearing makeup and getting manicures wasn't even a thing. And it was actually looked at as a sign of weakness. Like that was like a weakness. Like sure, there's cheerleaders and they're really pretty, but like I was the sporty girl. Like I was not getting manicures and getting my hair done or like dyeing, like none of that. So I was kind of like, no, like,
yeah.
Why aren't you getting a manicure, man? Like, I just never, it just kind of rolled off me in this, in hindsight, in sort of a great way. I just never really thought about it like that. And then I think the guys that I surrounded myself with as far as co-writers and engineers were probably equally sort of, I wouldn't say they were effeminate, but also just like way more evolved in this way where it was like, yeah, everybody's equal here. And it felt really good.
Cool.
Yeah. So I don't know.
I was talking with a friend the other day. I don't harp too much on topic of race.
Yeah.
I do, but I see that it plays a factor.
Yeah.
I think largely people get along with people that they see themselves in or they have something in common with.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if, I think color plays a role in it because of the cultural aspect.
Yes.
But I think if a person, if Mary, you like sports and I like sports, well, Mary, we're going to be friends because you like sports.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's my job to just prove people wrong. Like, when I walk in the room and they underestimate me, my job is to rise above that and show them otherwise. So I would, there were times where I feel like I maybe internalize some of that, like when I would walk in the room to a big meeting and I was there to present my song and someone would ask me for a cup of coffee because I was the only girl in the room. So it's like, well, obviously you're the receptionist getting the coffee. And I would be like, well, I don't want any well, sure, I'll get you a coffee and I'll get myself a coffee if you want a cup. Like, I would be very accommodating, but sort of make it known that, like, I wasn't there to get them coffee, but sure, I'll get myself a coffee,
but like,
and I'll get you a coffee too. But then I also kind of loved, like, there was also just like that sweet spot where you kind of go, now it's time to present and you're going to buy my fucking song.
Yeah.
And I just got you a cup of coffee.
I'm going to make you eat shit.
Like, so it's funny. Like, I sort of, I liked that. And I think I learned a little of that from him where it was just like, yeah, you know, there's going to be people that judge you in that way. And in a way that maybe I was blissfully ignorant of, that I was like, yeah, you know what? There's a way to handle that. That can be good.
That could be good.
Powerful and positive.
Right.
It's not a chip on your shoulder. It's not like, oh God, that guy asked me to get him a cup of coffee. Now he's going to hate my song. Or now I have to do that. And like, oh, what? There was no conflict there. It was just sort of like, all right, yeah, I can do that. And I'm going to fucking blow your mind with this song right now.
It also goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the service role.
Right.
Like,
yes.
we're always still servicing.
Yes.
You
and there's
what I mean?
That. We're here to do a job.
We're here to do a job. So if that cup of coffee is going to get me to the next point. Cool, man.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a cup of coffee. Like, that's not a big deal.
That's cool. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
So how did you make the move out of Crushing? Because you were obviously like well-loved and well-received and people were like vibing with your stuff. And also props to your boss because he gave you a lot of freedom.
He did. Props to my boss.
Props to him.
I loved him. I love him still. Yeah. So basically the short story there was he made me a partner, which was like a huge... Huge
damn,
honor.
He showed you lots of love.
He showed me so much love. We schemed together. We made, you know, we had so many good business plans together. And basically what happened was the business landscape changed a lot.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And
what changed about the landscape of the business?
Well, mainly that, you know, I think with music becoming digital and licensing becoming a way bigger part of music for advertising, like people when I was first starting doing commercials, artists were not into selling their music to commercials. Like, it just wasn't a thing. It was like, that's selling your soul to the devil. So then there was a big change, basically, I think, because with Napster and all these like streaming services where music became basically free online, everybody needed to find new sources of income. So everybody decided like, hey, it's okay to sell our music for commercials. So all these record companies and artists started closing up to the ad industry, and it was taking a huge cut out of like our mom and pop business. So my,
because you didn't have to make the music yourself.
Now, no, it was like now you can just license it from all these cool indie bands and like Nick Drake, and like there were just some really big ads that happened that were super successful licensing music. So the landscape was changing, and I think that Joey and I both saw that. But I think the way that we saw to, you know, deal with that were pretty different. And, you know, so we amicably, my contract was basically up, and I said, you know, I'm just going to start my own place. I'm going to downsize. Like, that place was a huge facility on Union Square with like 10 writing rooms. And I was just like, I really want to be able to be more flexible where we can work with bands that want to record their music for licensing. I want to be able to represent bands. I want to be able to do work for hire. I just want to just be more lean and mean and more flexible. So I decided to start Frisbee, and that's what I did.
You know, there's one thing I wanted to go back and ask you about, because I was reading up on you, doing my research on Mary Wood.
Okay.
And you were pinning commercial jingles for like brands like Pepsi.
Yeah.
And like 7-Up. Was this during the Frisbee aspect of your career, or was it with Crush It?
That was with Crush It.
Now, when you're writing a jingle, say for instance for Pepsi, how does that even work? What's the origin process of making this all come to life?
I was just like kind of documenting that, because I feel like it's like a piece of history that people should know about.
And by the way, the joy of Pepsi,
is
humongous.
Yeah, it's kind of big. It's lasted. Yeah.
Joy the Pepsi, joy the bubbles, joy the fun, mm-hmm. joy the Pepsi, you on your tongue.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive. So like,
yeah.
How does that even happen?
Yeah. Like, so I guess like the so basically with that particular campaign, they came to us, and I loved this about this. They basically, the ad, typically doing a jingle, the assignment's coming from the ad agency, not from the brand. Like, it trickles down. The brand has certain markets they're trying to hit. The ad agency like synthesizes that with the brand and figures out like what they need to do as far as the marketing plan. So when it got to me, it was, and I wrote that with a guy named Clifford Lane, who was a big part of my writing while at Crutching. And they basically were like, hey, we've got, they had the tag. And the tag at the time was the joy of cola, not the joy of Pepsi. They were like, everybody's drinking bottled water. We want everybody to enjoy soda again. So I was like, all right, well, give me all the market research. Like, I want to know about this. I'm going to be writing the words. Like, show me. So they gave me like this 25-page thing, market research about what people enjoy and what they want to do and why they don't like soda and why they do like soda and blah, blah, blah. And then and then beyond that, it was really just like a pretty fundamental understanding that this is a song that needs to reach not a niche market. Like, this is a worldwide campaign. Like, write something catchy. Like, it was pretty open in that way. But I think at that time, like, Clifford and I really understood that the creative directors at the ad agency were really, they liked kind of organic stuff, but it needed to be modern to appeal to, you know, they liked organic in the sense of the 60s, but they like modern because it needs to appeal to kids, but it needed to appeal to people that are already drinking soda. So we kind of took a really non-genre specific approach to the music. But I think emotionally, you know, I really just thought about, it sounds so cheesy, but I really just thought about, because I actually like Pepsi and I'm actually just an occasional Pepsi drinker. So I was really just channeling like what it is, what do I like about drinking Pepsi? Like, what is it? And what are those times that I would drink a Pepsi? So it was really, that song really came out of channeling that emotion. And then, but that said, we did write like four demos for that. Like, we didn't write just one. Like, we would always write like three or four.
Yeah.
So we wrote a bunch. And that one, just for some reason.
Did you know that that one was special?
Totally knew it. It was so weird. It was like we had had some hits before, but it's like I just got chill. Like, we were doing it and we kind of had the joy of living, joy of, it's like, oh, that's it, that's the chorus, like, that's great, joy of fun, joy of fun. And then we're thinking about it, we're like, nah, but joy of cola, that's not a tag, like, what is it, like, we gotta keep going. And then we were just kept going into the night. And then it was like, yeah, it just needs some non-lyrical. And it was just like, ba, 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 yes. And I will never forget that. She's like, the joy of cool. We were like, I mean, I literally was like laughing as we did it. It was so funny. We were just like, holy fuck, this is so great. And we were literally just like recording it like into a little, you know, tape recorder. It was just like, okay, this is so great. And then we got our friends in to like play. I just remember we were all in this one big room. We got the drummer in to play that beat. And we just knew, like, it just had such a good energy about it. We had this hippie friend in that happened to be visiting from Vermont. And he was just sitting there, like, tapping his head as we did it. Like, it just felt so endorsed. And I think that verse lyric was a little different at the time. But we just knew that that chorus was so good. And it literally, like, we submitted it. And we had already done a Pepsi campaign that, like, the Spice Girls had done. Like, we felt like we had an in, but, like, no, come to find out, they had called, like, 100 people to write on this new thing, and we didn't hear anything for quite a while. And it literally was keeping me up at night, because I was, like, you know, they say, like, that earworm? It was in my ear, and I was, like, I know this fucking song is so good. Like, can I just call the head of BBDO? Like, can I just overstep right now and just tell them? Like, I really wanted to just... Because I just knew, but I couldn't, it wasn't my place to say. And, you know, it just sounds self-serving. So, like, what am I doing? Hey, I'm the greatest. You just, like, so I just let it lie. And then, like, next thing I knew, they were like, yeah, we're going to go with this. And we're going to go with basically the demo we did. That was the first version.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's crazy.
And then what was it like seeing, you know, other famous people?
Oh, God.
Like, I like to write songs.
Yeah.
And for me, they mean something emotional, right?
Like, yeah.
I remember where I was and who the song was about. And then to see someone else, like, sing it and have it take on, like, new life.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa. But then when you have, like, famous people singing the lyrics that you wrote, like, oh, what does that feel like?
Oh, it's insane. It's so...
Who's the first famous person?
So the first, it was Aretha, and that experience was absolutely crazy.
You ain't heard nothing yet. Hit it, fellas.
Was like, okay, as you probably know, she doesn't travel, like, or she doesn't fly. So it was like, okay, we're gonna fly to Detroit, we're gonna record Aretha. And I was like, so
you went?
Oh yeah.
What?
Oh yeah. So I flew to Detroit because they needed someone to produce the session, right, to represent the agency. So it was like myself, my friend Ronnie Voss, who's the music producer at BBDO, and then a bunch of account people that work at BBDO. And we go to the studio and we get there and they're like, everyone's all a flutter. They're like, okay, they have like the heaters on in the bathroom to make sure it's the right temperature. They've got like the Chinese food delivered. Like, she's got her list of things, but this is the studio she said she needed to do it at. So I'm just like, so nervous. She walks in the room, walks in the studio. She's like, I want my ribs and I want some fried rice. And they're like, okay. And she doesn't even acknowledge me. She goes into the room. She puts her headphones on. She's like practicing. And I'm noticing as she's practicing, she's actually singing an older lyric, like a lyric that was not the current lyric. And I'm like, okay, so she got the thing we sent, but she's like practicing it. And she's like, because I'm not sure how this goes. So she's kind of playing it like she didn't know what she was getting into, but actually knew. She kind of did. But, like, she's doing the song, and I'm sitting at the
The console?
Or? Yeah, at the console with the engineer. And she's doing like, it's like so amazing. This is so great. But like, honestly, like there was one thing she kind of needed to do over. Like, you know, she'd done one take. It was mind blowing, but like, we're not going to be fixing a lot of stuff. So I was like, I think his name was Michael. I was like, do you think you could just ask her to get that back section like one more time? He's like, I'm not telling her. You tell her.
Oh, shit.
So I'm like, finger shaking, going on the talk back. And I was like, I'm sorry, Miss Franklin. Do you think you could get that one more time just at that end? And she's like, why? And I was like, you know how these ad people are. They just need options. And she's like, and I was like, but you know, it was amazing. We just need like one more pass at that end. So we get that really big end. And so then she just like blows it out of the park. And then she looks over at me and Ronnie, another woman. And she's like, ladies. So that's always a running joke. Like, did I do it? She's like, ladies. Cause I think she realized like, I'm here for you and you're here for me. Like, I'm not here to like bust you. Like, I just want it to be great. So and when she was doing the like, joy of living, joy of life. As she was pregnant, she looks at me, she's like, this is my favorite part. And I was like, that I always keep with me. Like, she had a favorite part of anything I ever did was just, that was incredible.
And so what was that feeling like when that commercial came out and that aired?
Oh, it was so great. But honestly, like, it's funny with like work for hire stuff, because as much as I love that commercial, I just felt like, wow, I wish I could have seen her more on camera. Like, I wished, like, that commercial was cool and they did a cool thing. But it's funny how I, you know, that experience in the studio was so exciting. I almost wish they had captured more of that in the ad. But I know that that's just, you know.
I have a business question to ask.
Yeah.
Like, as a writer of the jingle, even though you're working under the umbrella company, do you get like royalties as the writer of the jingle, even though you're an employee of the umbrella company?
Yeah. So the way it works usually with work for hire is so the brand will own the publishing and they'll get those royalties. We keep the writer royalties as the writers. I'm not sure all companies work that way, but Clifford and I, who wrote the jingle, kept that. And then you get performance royalties. Like, we were on the background vocals and we were musicians. So there's royalties that come
in. You were in the background vocals too?
For like ASCAP and BMI. And then, yeah, just those background things.
You saying background with Aretha?
Oh, did I not mention that I sing with Aretha Franklin?
Oh, yo, that's huge.
No, yeah. She wasn't there when I did it, but.
Yeah, that's so dope.
Yeah, no, great. That's actually one of the things, as a total aside to the jingle world, that I was always really shitty at singing background vocals. I was always, that was like an Achilles heel for me. Like, I could do it a little bit doing my stuff at home, but like being at Crushing, where there were so many great singers, it was all about group singing. And I learned so much about harmonies and vocals and like blending people and what that brings. That was a really great aspect of working there. It was really fun. And about that era,
Were you part of the 7-Up campaign as well?
I was, it was interesting that I sang that and I wrote a lot of the lyrics for that. That was a really funny, I feel like that's sort of a classic, like, happy accident situation where someone else named Billy Alessi, who worked at Crushing, had he'd made the track and it had a totally different top line on it. And he'd written it as like a demo for Jell-O or something. And the music producer he'd done it for called me up in a panic. And he's like, we're doing a pitch for 7-Up. And I feel like that Jell-O thing that Billy wrote could be really great if you could just like rework it and make it for 7-Up. Could you just like do that for me like right now? It was literally like 2:00 and I was like in the afternoon. It needed to be like 6:00. So I was like, okay. So we just like pulled it up and I just started like riffing on it. And Billy was in there. We just kind of, and I was like, this is so low for me. Like, I sound ridiculous singing so low, like this is not, but we just kind of made it work and it became this big hit.
It's the way it makes you feel, it's the lift that you get, it's a rhythm in your step, cause it's cool and it's wonderful and it's lemon and lime. It's an up thing.
It's an up thing. Like, that was like, that was really the first thing I ever did that I was like, oh my God, I remember calling my mom and being like, man, I feel like I hit the lottery. Like, I sang it and I made royalties, and people loved that vocal, and it was so funny because it was just really
That was during the like 7 Up. It's an up thing.
It's an up thing.
7 Up, 7 Up. Yeah. It's an up thing. 7 Up, 7 Up does it every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yo, I know all these jingles. Like, I watched a lot of TV as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. No. Yeah. So that's how I was, and I guess it just fed my career. It paid off.
So did you have to pin like the lyrics to the 7 Up ad as well?
Yeah. 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 And Billy helped, but yeah, the two of us basically. They had It's an Up thing, but then we did the whole It's a Given, It's a Way It Makes You Feel, blah, blah. Yeah.
That's so fly.
It was great. It was fun and hilarious. I'll never forget, actually, I was in a cab once. I went to like Detroit for something, and I got in a cab, and that was playing on the radio. And I said to the cab driver, I was like, oh, that's me. And he's like, what? I was like, that's me singing. And he's like, no, nah, that's a black girl singing. And I was like, because I think it was so low. It was almost like a really bad ripoff of like.
Anita Baker?
Yeah. Or like, oh God, what was that guy's
name? That wasn't a bad ripoff. You did a great job.
No, but it was more like, I'll think of it later. There was like a really funny like dude that would do these low, funny vocals. But it was just like, I was like, oh no, that's actually me. And he's like, okay. He don't think he believed me, but it was really funny.
And what made you strike into Frisbee and entrepreneurship? Like, how'd that happen?
So I think having been a partner at Crushing, I got a really good sense of the business side of things. And they were honestly really, I think I was always really, having come from an ad agency, I also had a good sense of the back end and how it worked. So I felt like I had a good business sense. I felt like Crushing's model was dying, like it was just getting old, and I needed to streamline. So I had a couple nickels to rub together, and I was like, if I'm not going to do it now, I will never do it. So I just basically told Joey when my contract was up, like, I'm going to go. And my whole idea was, again, to try to have a more fluid model where we could do work for hire, we could do licensing, we could, you know, bring artists on and develop them, and with an eye toward either licensing or releasing records, and just be more fluid. So I luckily, through a series of accidents, like found this space. My whole idea was like, I'm gonna live where I work because I can't afford two rents. Like I haven't, as much as I'm a risk taker, I'm a very moderated risk taker.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, all right, I can afford to live here and work here. So that's what I did. I moved into Frisbee and lived here during the construction, and luckily had a campaign for Reebok in the wings that I had orchestrated between like all the guys in Dr. Dre's camp and Dre's engineers and A&R guys and Reebok, because Reebok was trying to do a rebrand and they really needed legitimate rappers and hip hop music, and they knew that I had that connection to Dre and all his guys, which is a whole other story. But it was sort of great because it was like I was doing the construction here, Dre's guys were in LA doing the music, but I was still getting paid to sort of orchestrate this.
I was just producing.
Yeah. So that was a really fortunate way that I kind of bridged the, you know, two worlds. And then.
And that was your first client under Frisbee was Reebok?
Was Reebok. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. Damn. It was good. That was fun. That was a really.
They're up and coming.
Yeah, up and coming, exactly. Exactly. No, that was great. And it was a really, again, it was fun because it also gave, I love being involved with the hip hop world. Like, I just feel like advertising is generally pretty white and it's gotten a lot better. But for me, like, part of what I can bring to the table is a more integrated vision and approach, which is hilarious coming from this skinny white girl from New Hampshire. But I just feel like I love that, and I appreciate being able to do that. And I think with the Reebok campaign, I was a really good, you know, conduit for that. And, you know, that's happened a few other times, which is really nice. But that was the start.
You kind of remind me of a guy named Scott Schrier. Do you know who Scott Schrier is?
Yeah, Not Just Jingles.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Scott? I don't know him. I know who he is.
Okay, Scott's my guy.
Okay, I need to meet. You can connect us.
Yes, Scott, you remind me a lot of Scott.
Mm.
And because in our interview, we talked about how the industry's changed.
Yeah, he's...
And how he's been able to just...
He's been ahead of the game.
He's like the Madonna.
Yes, agreed.
You know, like constantly reinventing himself in this industry.
Yes.
Which I think is humongous. So what keeps you being innovative? Like, you've been in the industry now for over 20 years.
Yeah, totally.
And the industry's completely changed. Like, what's kept you innovative?
Yeah. Well, I guess part of it is just, wanting to be successful. So, like, you always have to stay ahead of things, right? So you always kind of have to see where the business is going and see where you fit in. And for me, it's like, it's that, and it's also wanting to stay creative. Like, the last thing I want to do is just be, like, continuing to do the same thing over and over again and, like, hope that someone eventually likes it again. So, like, I've given up a lot of, like, I feel like as a writer, you know, there's certain things I can bring to the table, but Frisbee is not about me as a writer, whereas I was Crushing, my whole role was really about writing, and now it's more about facilitating other people. And so the motivation is partially monetary, but it's also partially just wanting to stay creatively fresh and, like, following what's going on. Like, that's kind of exciting to me. It's like, okay, let's follow what's happening and figure out a way to fit in with that or get ahead of that and keep making money.
And how has the market changed from your days at Crusher to your early days in advertising to your days now here at Frisbee?
It's changed a lot. I mean, I think that the main difference between Crushing days and now is that there's a lot more non-union work that happens. So, like,
what does that mean? I'm sorry.
So, no, it's fine. So basically, when I worked at Crushing, you know, when you wrote jingles or even, you know, something without vocals or, like, any kind of underscore, everything was done through the music union, through the AFFM, or the singers union, which is, you know, tied in with SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. Mm-hmm. So you get royalties every single time the commercial's on. So, like, the fees up front that came from the ad agencies were kind of like, oh, that's nice, I got a little bit of money, pay my rent this month. But the big money really came from all the back end, from the performance fees from these unions. And now, because of it's a little complicated, but basically with the advent of licensing, when you license a song, there's a huge gray area about whether or not you need to pay union royalties anymore. So a lot of people don't pay back end anymore. Like, I used to be able to pretty much exist on SAG and AFM, and now that's like,
What's AFM?
The American Federation of Musicians. So, okay. So like a lot of agencies now are not associated with those. They're not signatories to those unions, so they don't pay the union anymore.
Okay.
A lot of stuff is non-union or, you know, under the table, so to speak. So it's all about the upfront fees. So that's the big difference, is like, I'm looking more at the big deals. I need to make the deals up front, and that's all I'm getting. Whereas before it was like, if you buy this, I'm set. I know that through the back end royalty fees, I'll be set over 6 months. So it's just like a different negotiation.
About like the discovery of music for advertising? Like,
yeah.
How does it go about? Do you go about now making music, you producing it, or how do you discover new talent or discover songs? And
yeah, new talent. You know, it's funny. the word lazy comes to mind, which is so bad. I'm not lazy about it. I think I tend to, like, lock into certain people. Like, I feel like I'm really good at, like, finding talent, and I'm really specific about it. It's all about vibe and sound. Like, but so sometimes it's through meeting people in person, and a lot of it is just through my relationships. Like, I have really good relationships with a lot of musicians and producers, and I pursue them to the fullest extent in the most honest and sincere way. So I think that's the main thing, is that I just really have a great reputation for being fair and honest, so that when I meet someone really talented, a lot of time I meet a few more really talented people. And I'm honestly not, like, on SoundCloud every day just trying to cherry pick people, because, you know, if someone has, like, two great tracks, like, that's not really enough for me. Like, it's more about, like, do you show up on time? Do you, you know, can you write by assignment? Can you, there's a lot of rigor that goes through that. So for me, it's a lot more about just an exponential, you know, family tree, so to speak. if that makes sense.
No, totally. Yeah. What makes a good jingle writer?
Yeah. Well, I think
I have a take.
Yeah. Okay.
But I want to hear your take, and that's okay. My take.
I mean, my, you know, personally, just because I guess I'm a good jingle writer, like, I feel like personally for me, like, I think a great sense of melody is, like, A number one. Like, you need, melody is A number one. Like, that's it. And then lyrics. Really a craft. If you have your craft of lyric writing down to a super specific level, like I always equate it to like writing a haiku. It's like you've basically got like a 3-line verse, a 1-line bridge, and maybe a 2-line chorus. Like, can you tell a whole story in that much? Like, it's a super amount of focus. And then I think beyond that, you know, if you don't have the production skills, do you have a partner that's a good producer? Because it always comes with, you know, now it's not enough to just like have the melody and the lyrics and like the tune. Like, you need the good producer. So you, if you're not in a company where you can just like grab the right person, like, you know how to, you know, partner with the right producers and engineers to make your shit sound the way it needs to sound.
Because my what I was going to say was, you have great sense of sensory.
Yeah. Oh,
like, okay. Sensory words, like certain words like kind of trigger.
Right.
Drake's really good at this. Mm. Drake's really good at telling people what they want to hear.
Right. Yeah.
In a particular moment.
Yeah.
And there's certain words that he uses.
Like, yeah.
To bring that emotion out.
Right. That's interesting.
Or even in like Enjoy a Pepsi.
Yeah.
Like picking out the things about the small things about Pepsi.
Right. Yeah. Totally.
That makes Pepsi great without saying Pepsi.
Right. Exactly.
So what's everything else about Pepsi that's awesome?
Yeah.
Without saying the product's name.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny you say that, because I remember when we first started writing, like Clifford and I were both like really inexperienced at writing jingles. We were just pretty good at writing pop songs. Like, we would typically like write something and then be done, and we'd present it and they'd be like, you forgot to say the product.
Yeah.
And we'd be like, all right, well, yeah, we'll just throw it in the background. Because like you say, you just kind of take the universal, like the specific yet universal qualities, and you put them in there. And I think in that sense that I'm, and maybe what would make a good jingle writer too, is just like being comfortable with embracing like the universality of an experience. Whereas now I think that that's less, I think things are way more targeted, and it's like, whereas that it's like, oh yeah, experience the joy of this and the joy of that. Like, everybody loves that, right? Like, I'm comfortable with that. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I think it just, I don't know. I think like someone like Apple,
yeah,
where they never talk about anything about the computer.
Never.
It's about this overlying,
yeah,
theme, or yeah, they want you to pull. They pull the emotion out of the product.
Exactly.
They don't really talk about the product.
Right.
That's one thing I noticed about when I went through like the lyrics of, like some of your past work.
Yeah, yeah.
Was just the element of, it's not about the specific, it is about the product, but you're going to feel joyful regardless.
No, exactly. No, it's so funny, because I think that Clifford and I really hit this interesting transition in the jingle world, where it was like, before he and I were writing, and I'm not saying we transformed it, but I think it was just like a natural timeline. I think before I was really into it, it was really literally like, Pepsi, for those who think young. Like, it was like very prescribed.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the licensing thing and artists maybe getting in, maybe that was sort of influencing like that Clifford and I got into it, because we literally just would like write a song with a general emotion attached to it with the brand in mind. I think we thought very differently than the guys that had been doing it for like 20 years before us. Like, they were way more. So I think we sort of hit a sweet spot that was like, it's a jingle, but it sounds a lot like a song.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think after that, pretty not long after that, it just became like, oh, let's just license a song. Like, we don't even need to do this in-between thing that's like a branded song. Like, let's just license a Beyonce song or whatever. Yeah.
And so what advice do you have for artists? Because you've been able to, you know, really find the sweet spot balance. Like, one thing why I started this podcast.
Yeah.
Is showing people that you can be creative,
yeah,
but you don't have to be number one on Billboard, to be creative.
Yeah.
There's a space for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to be LeBron James, but you could be a really good general manager, or you could be the owner of a team.
Right.
Or you could be the doctor.
Right.
You know, for the team. Yeah. And you've really found the sweet spot in your life of I'm creative, but I'm also like a professional. I'm also like
You know? Wearing a lot of hats.
And you're also making songs that are just as recognizable as some of the rappers that we love or like singers that we love. What advice do you have for creatives in the creative space?
Interesting. I feel like you just listening to your inner voice and really being honest with yourself about what you're good at and maybe what you could get better at and like just lean to your strengths and lean hard into those, but also like keep learning about the business around you, but don't let the business side of it lead you. I think let your heart lead you, because when your heart leads you, that's where you're going to be really successful. But like truly your heart, like be honest with yourself. Do you just love this, like singing in the shower, or are you getting do you feel some resonance around you from people that you have something going on? Like I think you really have to follow your heart in a really honest way and, you know, take your lumps to a degree, but I think don't sell out. Don't chase your tail. Like trying to get the business deal first. Like I think if you want to be creative, you should really stick with what you know deep down you're good at and have the potential to be good at, which is a tricky conversation to have with yourself, right?
Well, Mary, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate you telling your story. You're a true inspiration.
Thank you. It's great to hang out with you.
Yeah, you're the greatest.
Awesome. Thank you. You too.
Later, Mary.
All right.
Mary!
Cheers.
Thank you so much to the Silent Giants behind this episode of the Silent Giants Podcast. This episode has been mixed by Mark Bird of MBM Studios, located in Astoria, Queens, NYC's number one recording studio for music, podcasting, and other audio recordings. Be sure to follow them on Instagram at MBM Studios NYC. I'm your host, Corey Cambridge, signing off till next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.